Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Cale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujeet Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to another edition of the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 66, being recorded on the 25th of February, 2015. I'm Sujeet Mello, and on Skype with me, I have Evan Basilek. Our normal colleague, Cale Teeter, is out in a warm place, which is good for him. He's vacationing this week. Where is he, Evan?
And I think he's in Cancun, but I'm just hating him. So
I know. I mean, you got there dealing with the snow over there, and yeah. We're dealing with the cold weather up in New Jersey. Oh, my goodness. It's just has not been warm in, I don't think it's been above zero. 32 degrees in a long time.
That's kind of what I'm hearing from my family up north, that like, they're like, it gets above freezing, does it? We seem to recall that happening, but not recently.
But I'm glad that Cale's having a nice vacation. I'm sure he deserves that. He's had a rough couple of weeks at his customers. Yeah. But, normally we've done a lot of, we've just had a big line of guests that we've been interviewing, right, for the last few episodes. And so it's nice to just take an episode just to chit-chat about some loose ends, things here and there.
Yep. No, definitely. I think we had a great run, and we've got more coming up, but sometimes we'll step back and just kind of go back to our old format a little bit.
Excellent. Yep. So before we get, there's a particular topic we want to talk about today, which is something called the gatekeeper pattern for ensuring that VMs remain healthy in Azure when you have custom software, and we'll talk about that in a little more detail and how it relates to some stuff that runs in Azure as well as your custom VMs. But before that, Evan, I believe you had posted a couple of interesting tidbits about SQL Azure.
Yeah, so you know me. I mean, I have great love for SQL Azure because I used to support it. And yeah. They had two really cool things that released recently. One of them, SQL Database V12, they're calling it, I think, is, it's now GA in Asia, right? So it kind of did a rolling release across the world. So it's not completely complete news. But it definitely is, now world over. But V12 is really cool because, it really brings a lot more compatibility with the on-premises version of SQL Server. Right? That was always one of the real challenges with SQL Database. Got to keep up with the times.
Mm-hmm.
But with SQL Database is that there's a lot of things you couldn't do in it compared to the on-premises version. Now we're a lot closer in capabilities, and this, just makes it easier to move, right, to migrate.
Right.
So the other thing is what they're calling dynamic data masking. And I thought this was actually really interesting because it's starting to show the benefits of service, right? So, think about a world where, you've got credit card information in the database,
mm-hmm.
right? You want to make sure in an ideal world that your application, even if somebody could figure out a way to do, let's say they do some SQL injection or something like that, you want to minimize their ability to get at sensitive data, right? Or somehow somebody got to a section of the site that they shouldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. So what dynamic data masking says is it changes so that the typical URL for a SQL database is, something.database.windows.net. So what they have now is you can turn on this dynamic data masking for certain fields, say credit card, social security number, and then you give your application a slightly different connection string. And so the connection string is going to be database.secure.windows.net. And now, so when you go in the portal and configure data masking for these couple of fields, if you're coming in with this database.secure.windows.net connection string, even if you run the same query that you would do on the non-secure version, you'll get back, your data will be masked, right? So you'll have XXX, the last four digits of your, of the social security number or some variant like that. So, it doesn't really, no matter what you do with your query, that any application coming in with that connection string is always going to get the masked data instead of the raw data. And then if you go back, so you could imagine a world where you have kind of the internal application, you know, where you want, you know, you need full fidelity, you need the, you know, the real numbers. That one can see, you know, you go in through the database.windows.net route,
right.
And then your public-facing application, which is always at more risk, right, no matter what you do,
right.
That one comes in with the .secure.windows.net, and there is absolutely no way that somebody can get back this sensitive data.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
And that's, I'm sure that's going to be very important for, I guess, the medical field,
yeah.
Right,
yeah,
that comes to mind right away, or
yep.
Financial fields.
Yep.
You know, that's a hard do we have any medical customers? Are you aware of medical customers just in general that field that use Azure?
I have to go look at the white papers on the, you know, on the public testimonies and stuff that we've got. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I would be really surprised if we don't have some, because a couple of the components, I think storage for sure is HIPAA compliant, but I'm not sure about some of the other stuff.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and look at the Trust Center to dig through what the current status of all that is.
Okay, great. That's a nice piece of information there. So wanted to just cover one topic today. This is something that I've had on my mind for a while, and I'm glad we have this little open episode today to talk about it. It's something called the gatekeeper pattern. So we all know that the Azure services, typically if you use the PaaS services, it's easy to get to make sure that you're always up as long as you have more than one instance, right? That's the SLA that's provided to you. And then Azure will, you know, the Fabric controller will make sure that at least one of those instances are available all the time. But if you have VMs, your own custom VMs, yes, you know, you can have more than one VM, and therefore, you know, you can, I think they will try to make sure that at least one of them is up all the time. But the thing is that VMs contain a lot of custom software, right? And there is nothing, I mean, Azure doesn't know that, hey, the software on your VM is actually broken, right? You had an exception in your application, or it stopped working, you ran out of memory. It's not going to be, you know, it's not all
the OS is still up at that point, right?
Exactly. The OS is up. It looks healthy, but your app is just not doing anything. So you could have two perfectly good VMs up and running as per Azure, but none of them are working, right? And your app is down. So what we have to do in these scenarios is to create some sort of a way where both the VMs, let's just take two for example, and I think we can extend that discussion to more than two later on. But let's suppose you had two VMs that were identically set up. You have the same software in both of them. And I've implemented something like this for one of my own hobby sites that I've been working on. And my use case was that I was using, I had installed a VoIP service on each one of those VMs. And the way VoIP works is that it kind of wants just one VM, one instance of the VoIP thing to be running at any given time. Okay?
So it's really, just to kind of level set and make sure, because I don't know a ton about that software, but it's not like an IIS application where it's, you know, either static or dynamic content, but if you do a load balancer, you have the same stuff on each VM, and it doesn't really matter which one you hit.
Correct.
VoIP is stateful rather than stateless.
Okay. Very well put. Yes, it is stateful, and it's a steady TCP connection that's always on. I guess they use SIP, right? Is the protocol that's used in VoIP.
Yep.
And it has to be connected to one particular endpoint, one particular machine. So I can't have two of them on because, you know, I have to set up a load balancer, and it would be sending some traffic here, some traffic there, and you know, you just can't have it like that.
Yep. Yep.
So, in that kind of a scenario, how do you ensure that, okay, you've got a custom image on one VM, a similar image on another VM? You want to make sure that at least one of those VMs is healthy from an application perspective at any given time. Okay. And you want it to be automatic. So, let's suppose You know, we all know that occasionally the Azure VMs get bounced, right? They're updating the. I know we.
No, they're not. They don't never.
They have to upgrade the fabric controller or the software underneath or whatever it is, and they take a quick reboot cycle. And you want to make sure that the other VM then picks up the slack or picks up that downtime and the application continues working. So how do you make these two things work? So one way to do it is something called the gatekeeper pattern, as I had alluded to earlier. And the gatekeeper pattern, what it is that it says is that each of these VMs is running some software that is looking at a common object, okay, and they're getting a handle to that object. And as long as they have a handle to that object, they can keep on working, and the other VM, which does not have the handle to the object, is not going to run its software. It's going to be up and running, but the software is not going to be active on the other VM.
Okay.
All right, so only the VM that has the handle to this global object is going to be running its software. And in case that application goes down, the VM gets bounced, or whatever happens, then the other VM would now capture the handle to this global object, and it would start its services, and it would start responding to, in this case, VoIP requests.
Okay? So if this is a global object, and either VM has to get access to it, it can't be on the VMs then, right?
Very well put. Yes, it cannot be on the VM. You want it to be something different, and you know they. I looked around on the news groups for examples of how best to do this. The one thing that came up was using the storage blob.
Okay.
So you can actually create a dummy storage blob item. I created a simple text file. I just say hello world and I saved it, right? And that's my storage blob. And using the .NET API, you can write a program to acquire a lease on this storage object. And when you acquire a lease, it's an exclusive lease on the object. What that means is that if somebody else, another application, is also trying to acquire the lease, it would get an error because the first...
Because it can't get the lease on it.
It can't get the lease.
Already, okay.
Exactly. It's just like a lease. You know, I lease an apartment, so I lease this particular object. Nobody else can lease it while I'm leasing it.
But can you sublease?
Probably a way to do it. You know these Azure guys. They're smart. So I decided to use that to my advantage. So we created this Azure, this blob, which is, as you mentioned, on neither of the VMs. It's a PaaS service. It's always available. So we know the blob's always going to be available, right?
Yep, okay.
So that's a managed service. And I wrote a small .NET program. I called it the gatekeeper.exe, which is running on both the VMs. And as soon as the VMs come up, this application comes up, this program comes up, and it tries to acquire the lease. If it's the first one up, it acquires the lease successfully. And the moment it acquires the lease, it kicks off a script, which does a little command script, which essentially starts up all the essential services on that computer. That, in my case, it's starting up the VoIP system, and it is starting up. I do use IIS as well to serve up some minimal HTTP traffic, so it's starting that up as well. So it starts that up. And the other machine that was unsuccessful in getting the lease is not going to start it up. Those services are going to be down on the other computer, on the other VM. However, the gatekeeper program is still running on the other computer. It is waiting for its opportunity to acquire the lease.
So this is kind of a separate little, you know, PowerShell script or executable or something that's trying to get that lease.
Correct.
Okay. Yep. So it's not built into the app. You kind of had to layer it on top of.
Yes. And you bring up a good point. It's probably possible to do this with PowerShell. Me being a .NET developer, I just leaned that way, and I wrote a simple console application. It's literally a little console application that's running, and it's in the auto start script of the computer, so it starts up automatically every time the computer is booted. So I don't have to do anything.
Okay.
The computer comes up, the script is running, and it's completely hands off. Now, So we've established a scenario where each one of these computers now can acquire the lease and make sure that the services are running on that computer only. Now, what happens if I shut down the gatekeeper program on the computer that has acquired the lease? So when I do that, it runs another script that shuts down all the services on that computer. Because I'll come to why in a minute, but we don't want to have the services up and running if the computer is not going to be serving traffic.
Well, because at that point, I'm just trying to think this through, but the software load balancer has its probe.
Correct.
So if there's something there to respond, it's going to try and send traffic there. So that's why you have to take them down, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I created what they call a load balance set.
Yep. Right? Okay.
So both these VMs are on a load balance set, and the port 80 and the whatever the white port are listed as being, you know, pingable ports.
Yep.
And so, as you know, the way it works is that any computer where that port is responding will get traffic from the load balance set. In my case, I only have two VMs, so it's either one or the other. It's never both. Because my gatekeeper program always ensures the services that are running only if it has acquired
right.
lease to the global object, to the blob. So by setting up this load balance set, I mean, this thing has worked remarkably well, this little setup over here, through all the, you know, the maintenance cycles and everything in Azure. Every time I go there, I always see that one of the VMs is always in the active state. The other one is just sitting and waiting to acquire the lease. And I just thought it would be, you know, I'm sure our listeners might have similar needs where they have custom VMs that, you know, need to have the similar setup. And Evan, I believe you were mentioning something that you may have some background on some of the Azure services that use the same feature.
Yeah, I mean, actually, to be honest, it's one of the real core services, and this is something I talk about in some of my presentations that I do talking about Azure VPN. So Azure VPN is, you know, today, and it's an implementation detail. So, you know, to those of us, to our audience that's listening, you know, take this with I don't want to say a grain of salt, but this is subject to change at any mm-hmm. time. But today, when we implement Azure VPN, we do that with Windows RAS, right, which has been around since NT4.0, you know, very well tested, very solid product. Mm-hmm. And then we deploy it onto standard Windows PaaS instances, and then we use PowerShell to configure it, and then we use some additional code on top of that that does the gatekeeper pattern, right? We've got, you know, a couple of blob leases to make sure that only one side's actually listening at any given time. And, you know, we do this on a massive scale. So clearly there's, you know, I'm not saying yours is not a real world scenario, but there's also, you know, you can do enterprise level business applications with this as well.
Okay. That's good to know. So it's a well-established pattern then.
Yeah.
For if you have custom VMs that do this kind of work.
Okay. So are you doing for yours, Sajid, are you doing yours as, it sounds like you're doing them as IaaS because you had to do a little bit. Sounds like you have to do a non-trivial amount of configuration up front.
It is, yeah. It's custom VoIP software and a bunch of other programs that just difficult to shoe in into a PaaS instance, you know.
Right, yeah, because that would be an interesting experiment to see if you could somehow get them all to install as part of the startup script, right, and then, you know, maybe configure them with PowerShell or whatever, and then you would really have, you could scale up to, you know, I don't know how many instances you really need, but it certainly shows that, you know, you can kind of go either way with this, right, PaaS or IaaS, and still get the same thing. It's just, is it easier to deploy your software on PaaS or IaaS? In your case, it's much easier to do IaaS, sounds like.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the nature, it's like, you know, it's like trying to install something like SQL Server on a PaaS, right? It just, you know, there's just too many moving parts.
I have seen somebody that did it.
Are you serious?
I'm not saying I thought it was a good idea, but they installed SQL Express on every pass it's since, and then they had some synchronization mechanism between them. But I saw it, and I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. I'm not sure that I would do that, but it's kind of cool nonetheless. So, yeah. But yeah, no, I certainly get it. I mean, there's a class of applications that to try and, you know, kind of programmatically install them on startup is, it's just not worth the effort.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, one of those initial challenges I had was with regard to the load balancer. My initial approach was to use the traffic manager,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I thought maybe that has actually something called the failover mode.
Yep. Yep.
Right. Which does something very similar. But the problem with the traffic manager is essentially a DNS load balancer, right? It's not a network load balancer. And it took too long for the DNS names to switch over.
Oh, by the time it propagated all the DNS changes.
Right.
Yeah.
So then, you know, when one went down, it was like in a 15, 20 minutes sometimes before it really flipped over, you know?
Yep, yep.
To F forever. In this particular scenario, the DNS never changes. It's just the load balancer will just, at literally within 15 seconds, will switch over. So it gives me a very good SLA for my particular little application there.
So have you found, you know, so you're using this in the real world, right, mm-hmm. as well. Have you, you know, again, and so if you look at it from that perspective, the real world perspective, you know, you have no idea which instance is running at any given time. You have no idea which instances, you know, just getting ready to fail over. Have you ever run into a window where, hey, you're in the middle of failing over? Or from your perspective, has it just been always up for months and months and months?
It's been... you mean, have I ever seen it in the process of switching over? Is that
yeah,
what?
I mean, I guess because, you know, to kind of bring it to like a real world, you know, a real world application where somebody's running a business on it, right?
Yeah.
You know, you build this stuff knowing that the failover will occur. You know that there's going to be a 15-minute, you know, gap where you might
seconds.
Not be at, or 15-second, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. gap where you're going to be down. But ideally, it's such a small percentage compared to the overall
yeah.
that as far as you're concerned, it's just up all the time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean, so that's kind of my question for you. Like, when you just go use this, it's always up when you go use it.
As far as I've never seen it down. Occasionally I'll deliberately take one of them down because I want to update the software. You know. Mm-hmm. So then that's another reason I have this facility is that I just stop the gatekeeper on one of them,
yep.
on the active node or on the inactive node. It doesn't matter. Update the software, bring up the gatekeeper again, go to the other one, shut down the gatekeeper. The moment I do that, it shuts down all the services, and immediately the load balancer switches to the other machine, and I can update the software and bring it up. So, it gives me that update domain, fault domain kind of scenario in VMs.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's almost like its own – I mean, I guess if you look at, like, the on-premises world, and maybe – I don't know which predated which, but I mean, clustering basically does that with like a shared volume.
Yep.
Right. I guess, do you know, is clustering, did clustering come from the gatekeeper pattern or did the gatekeeper pattern bring clustering around?
I know clustering used that heartbeat, right? The heartbeat mechanism.
Yeah.
And the heartbeat mechanism, I don't know, I'm not sure if it uses like this common shared object. We get to use the gatekeeper pattern and the common shared object here because we have this third object, which is the blob, which is elsewhere. But
yep.
if you have a cluster with two things, you know, then you sort of have to keep pinging each other because there is no third thing to rely
on.
Yeah,
that's true. You know? I guess that's where they do have shared volumes for some types of clusters, but I don't know if that overrides the heartbeat. I'm not a cluster enough guy, but no, but that's, I mean, that's amazing that you can take really just a random piece of software,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you could even imagine doing that with, and not that you would want to do it, but, you know, you could do that with SQL Server. You could do that with anything that's got a listener, even if it's not really load balancer aware.
Exactly, yeah. And I made it such that, you know, it's configurable, the scripts and all that, so you can use the gatekeeper pattern. I can use it for any of my VMs, not just the one that I use for this application.
Yeah.
It's just I just configure the name of the script, and that's it. You know, it does everything automatically. Cool. So that's great. And good to see that the IRAS system uses something very similar.
Yeah.
And that's good to know.
So so I'm going to challenge you at some point. You're going to have to try PowerShell. I've started doing it. Mm-hmm. It really feels like C#.
Yeah.
It's really been an easy jump. I just had to get over a couple syntactical things. But yeah, it's, I think, you know, you should try it at some point next time you go to tweak this or something like that.
I definitely will. As a matter of fact, I have started using PowerShell in general because, I've just started doing a lot of development on, using the new K runtime. I don't know if you're familiar with the K runtime.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I'm not super familiar with it, but.
This is our next version of .NET, you know, the new .NET, which is cross-platform.
Yep.
It runs on Linux, Mac, as well as on Windows. So they call it the K runtime. And that thing is all set up and installed by PowerShell scripts. They have one PowerShell script called kvm.ps1. So I've had to get really familiar with that. I use the GUI, the editor, what do they call it? The PowerShell.
The ISE,
yeah. Right? Yeah. And it's just nice. It's got a nice little development environment there. You can run your little commands, and it shows you the output, debugging, everything.
Yeah, so you ought to check out, there's an app that almost everybody I know who gets serious about PowerShell uses. It's called PowerGUI. It's kind of like PowerShell ISE ships with Windows, and it you're right, it has some nice features, but there's some additional benefit you get out of it. You get, like, you can see your variables, and you can do a little bit easier debugging when you do it with Power GUI.
I see. Okay.
So something else to try.
I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. Great. All right, I think that's a wrap for this episode then. Thanks a lot, Evan, for all that feedback.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks for sharing your scenario. It's really kind of neat to see. I don't know. I always find it kind of interesting when I see these, you know, the way we design these services, and, you know, I forget sometimes that, you know, they're not just for these services.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of neat to see a real world scenario of just something you've done. Right. So.
Right. Thanks.
Thanks for sharing.
All right. Well, then hopefully we'll have Kale all fresh and ready to go next week. And I think we'll have some special guests next week as well. So looking forward to that.
Yeah. Sounds great. See you then.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.